Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, U of A President Suresh Garimella on the school's financial crisis, pressures from the Trump administration, and more.
And inside the hard-hitting world of roller derby.
But first this morning, Arizona Republicans and Democrats don't agree on much. But there's one thing they have come together to fight against, Arizona's newest political party, the Arizona Independent Party. The two normally opposing sides came together in court yesterday to attack Secretary of State Adrian Fontes because he allowed the new third party to change its name to the Independent Party. They say it will only confuse voters who already call themselves independent with a little I. But the party is already running candidates under its new name. And here to tell us more about all that went down in court yesterday is our own Cameron Sanchez with KJZZ's Politics Desk. Good morning, Cameron.
Good morning.
Okay, so what's the argument coming from both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party here?
Yes, so them and the Citizens Clean Elections Commission.
Right, there's also that.
Everybody is ganging up together. So their argument is basically that Secretary of State Adrian Fontes, who happens to be a Democrat, was exceeding his authority by allowing this name change because there's actually not really a specific statute that addresses this. Mm. You know, if a party comes to the Secretary of State and says, hey, we're this party, we want to be called something else, what is he supposed to do in that situation? They're saying he doesn't have the power to just say yes to that, whereas his attorneys are saying, well, he also doesn't have the power to say no. So he was in a bit of a catch-22 situation.
Okay, so that's kind of what Fontes' attorneys said in his defense, that this is unclear, and if he had said no, he would have been out of line.
Right. They're saying that would have been the real overstep, is for him to say no based on no authority.
Okay. Okay. So, Cameron, give us some background on all of this, because it's been a winding road. Mm-hmm. It started with an entirely different party here, right? The No Labels Party.
Yeah. It's our new party from, I think, 2023. Mm-hmm. It was created here by a group who was under the National No Labels Party, and they have this in other states as well. But the National No Labels Party really just wanted us to run candidates in our higher up offices. So they wanted to run candidates for president and vice president, but they didn't want to have down ballot candidates like mm-hmm. No Labels candidates for school board or for state legislature, for example.
Sure, sure.
So that went to court because the court was asked to decide whether the party can bar people from running in those down ballot races just because party leadership doesn't want that. And the court said, no, you can't do that. Party leadership doesn't get to dictate who runs for these little races. You can't stop people from doing that.
And people had tried, right? Said,
right.
Oh, I'll be the no labels party candidate for this office. Okay.
So the national party then kind of broke with the state party and said, we're not affiliated anymore. You know, we don't really claim this.
But they had already established the party here, right?
Correct. Yeah. And we've got, I think, upwards of 40,000 voters who are a part of this third party here in Arizona now. So it's established more even than it was back in 2023. So now the party is being led by former Phoenix Mayor Paul Johnson. And they decided to, as part of their rebrand, also give themselves a new name. Mm-hmm. And the new name is the Arizona Independent Party.
Okay. So they said, we want to be the Independent Party. Mm-hmm. And Fontes said, okay, and now it's all in court.
Yes.
Let me ask you, Cameron, about the politics of this, right? Like, I've heard the word spoiler thrown around a lot here when it comes to candidates that are now running under this new Arizona Independent Party. Do Democrats or Republicans want a viable third party?
Of course not. No, why would they want more competition? That would be terrible for them. And I think it is kind of like funny to see the Democrats and Republicans on the same side fighting this common enemy, as you mentioned in the intro. But this whole thing about the Independent Party, their attorneys accused the Arizona Independent Party in court of trying to make it easier for non-Democrats and non-Republicans to get on the ballot, which is 100% true. Mm-hmm. And that's what they would say as part of their platform. Because if you're running as an unaffiliated voter unaffiliated party, you have to get a ton of signatures to even make it on the ballot. It's
right.
An uphill battle. It's really difficult. But if you're registered with a party, like you would be under the Arizona Independent Party, then you have an easier time. And so they're helping people get over that hurdle, and they want to create a viable third party. That is very much what they're pitching themselves as, and right. as a home for independent voters. And that is not something that Democrats or Republicans want.
Okay. So what has Paul Johnson, the leader of this new independent party, had to say about these legal challenges? What does he say this is all about?
Well, he obviously thinks that this is nonsense. I think, personally, we would have ended up in court either way. No matter mm-hmm. what Fontes did, he was going to be on the chopping block for this. But the Democrats and Republicans have been fighting this party at every turn. So I don't think he's surprised by it, but I think maybe he's a little frustrated, disappointed, you know, because we have the election season coming up and this is taking a lot of time and resources.
Right. And they do have candidates running, including for governor. Mm-hmm. Any sense how viable any of these candidates may be?
Well, I mean, every year or every election cycle, we have third party candidates who say this is going to be their time. And it usually is not their time. You know, we have effectively a two party system. But I think that it represents somewhat of a threat more than it has in the past. So never say never.
Right. And that's because this is an actual party. They can get on the ballot in an easier way.
Correct.
OK. What should we expect in terms of a decision from this judge?
Well, we should expect a decision within the next week because we have to get something out sooner rather than later to deal with election timelines. But he also said while they were in court making their arguments that he was, you know, not a really big fan of what the Independent Party has done with this name change. He seemed very suspicious and disapproving. He made some comments about, like, why would that be okay? And I don't think that this is appropriate. So it seemed, at least based on his mumbling and grumbling, that maybe he's not going to be in favor of this.
And if they have to change the name, they can pick anything else? Will it be more specific then?
Well, I don't know if they'll let them change the name, if they're going to force them to be the No Labels Party. But then that would create some other kerfuffles because we've already got some paperwork filed under the Arizona Independent Party name. So we would potentially have that to deal with as well.
Okay. Could be a bit of a mess, but we will wait and see what happens. That is Cameron Sanchez joining us from our politics desk. Cameron, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Suresh Garamella has been president of the University of Arizona for about a year and a half, and it's been an eventful tenure so far for the 23rd president of the university. He arrived in the midst of a budget crisis. The school had a more than $100 million hole to fill. The U of A was also one of nine universities invited by the Trump administration last year to sign what it called the Compact for Academic Excellence in Higher Education. The school ultimately declined. Garamella recently stopped by the studio to talk about all of that, as well as some of the other challenges higher education is facing more broadly. But we started with the budget, and I asked when he looked at the U of A's books right now, how they look.
You know, a lot of higher education institutions are actually needing to reconsider their financial models and things like that. So I was not too worried about the deficit that we'd heard. Again, there was a deficit of $177 million is what the number was that was thrown around. And as you know, we closed that deficit within the first 9 months. And so I came in October of 24 and July 1st, 25, we started the year with no deficit. And to me, that was a very important priority because, first of all, right, the campus community, the morale was low. There was this drip, drip, drip of bad news. And it was important to me to close that story, balance our budget, and focus on the things that the U of A has always been known for. It's an old university. It's a land grant. It's one of the top 20 public universities in the country in terms of research. We bring $1 billion of research in. So it was important to me to focus on that. But it was also important that we balance our budget without sort of firing a bunch of staff I made a point of emphasizing that we must give some raises to our staff and faculty. We also froze our tuition for our in-state students. We've done that now for a third year in a row. So we didn't do it in perverse ways. And even the way we balanced it, we cut 70% in my office. We cut about 22% across administrative units and about 3% in colleges. And so the way we balanced, I think, I wanted to show that we care about academics and holding that as harmless as we could. So I'm very pleased with where we got. And the whole campus had to cooperate, collaborate in this process. And I think the campus is happier as a result of where we are today.
So you mentioned research funding. I want to ask you about that because there's been so much talk about especially money from the federal government not being there or being threatened or actually taken away. U of A, obviously, as you mentioned, a big research university. Where are you in terms of securing federal grants?
Yeah. You know, certainly the situation with federal grants is a little uncertain right now. And there have been some grants that have been challenged and such. But the U of A is doing very well, for one thing. What I want to emphasize is that it all depends on the kind of work you're doing also. So we have, when we came here, my vice president for research and myself, we looked at our strengths and said, let's grow our strengths. Let's invest in our greatest strengths, and that will grow the research funding. And so what we picked was, we're number one in the world, really, in space and optical sciences. So how can we have that help the national security side of things, right? So space and national security was one emphasis area. Every university is working on AI, but we wanted to apply AI to improving health outcomes, especially rural health outcomes. We chose mining and critical minerals. Of course, Arizona is a mining state, right? And it's a critical national area of importance. So that was another. Of course, we've always been really, really good at water resources and arid region agriculture. So that was another area. And so, and fusion energy research, right? So these are the five that we picked because we have strengths in those areas. We picked these in October and November of 24. So this happened before the election. And yet we're very pleased that the federal government now is emphasizing those areas as being important to them. And so I am quite confident that we will continue to grow our research portfolio. The other piece of this is we also are focused on working with the private sector. For example, in fusion, there is $10 billion or so of venture capital in it, and we're trying to attract some of the companies to come set up in our tech park, et cetera. We need to get better at working with foundations, with philanthropic giving and such. I'm actually very optimistic about continued growth in our research, and we're supporting our faculty through any transitions with a bridge funding program and things like this so that we can tide them over across little challenging times.
Have you had projects that you've had to stop, not necessarily in those five areas that you've really sort of emphasized here, but in other, there's obviously much more research going on at the university than just those. Have you had professors or who have lost their projects or projects that have gone away?
We have. And, you know, that's come and gone too, right? We had some NIH grants, for example, that were stopped and they were reinstated afterwards, right? So the overall on the $1 billion budget, certainly the few professors who were affected, it is very an unfortunate situation for them. But it's not been a large proportion at all. It's been a fairly small fraction of our funding. And in instances like that, we are providing bridge funding. Particularly, we're focusing the bridge funding on graduate student support, right? If a student has been working for 3 years, 4 years on their PhD and they have a year left to go, we want to support them to finish their program. So I think between that, I mean, there's a lot of angst, of course, but we're working hard to diversify our portfolio of resources and funding, and I think we'll do okay.
What are you hearing from international students at U of A? I mean, there's been so much talk about if they leave the country, will they be allowed back? Might they be taken off the street and held somewhere and ultimately deported? Like, what have you heard and what kinds of steps have you tried to take to help your students who are from other countries?
Yeah. Well, I will just say that as somebody who's gone through all this, it was a long time back, but I came here as an international student. So, and as you know, the country is built on immigration, so I think we will always value the importance of immigration in this country. Of course, we are very careful and disciplined about following all the rules that are set. Our approach, Mark, has been to support our international students to the best of our ability. And we do that quietly. We provide them all the information they need. We give them any alerts that they should be familiar with. I don't think it's actually helpful to them, or it doesn't serve a purpose for us to make big, you know, pronouncements about this. But I would say that if you asked our international students, they would probably say they felt very well supported by our international programs office and such. The flip side of all this is that we're beginning now that the budget issues are behind us to some extent, right? We always have to be vigilant. But I was recently in Taiwan and led a group, a small group with me. And we're greatly deepening our partnership with the country of Taiwan. we're also doubling down on our study abroad program. So all this, to me, is part of the international engagement. We want to support our international students. We want to build bridges to specific universities, companies, governments overseas. We want to work more closely with Mexico, for example. We're working on that. So I think we'll be in good shape.
That's University of Arizona President Suresh Garamella. More of our conversation in just a moment. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, the duo taking a rock band approach to classical music.
But first, let's return now to my conversation with University of Arizona President Suresh Garamella. Last year, the Trump administration cut funding to minority-serving institutions. A release from the U.S. Department of Education said that followed a determination that Hispanic-serving institutions violate the Constitution. The U of A is a Hispanic-serving institution, and prior to the funding announcement, the school said it would consolidate seven cultural centers into one central hub. That decision did not sit well with some on campus, but I asked Garamella about his thought process when he's dealing with a federal government that has a different opinion on something, like diversity initiatives, than some percentage of people on campus, and how he tries to find a balance that won't draw scrutiny from the feds, but also continues to serve students and the rest of the campus community.
Mark, it's a good question, and obviously the balance, as that you mentioned, is important. And so this is where our focus helps a lot, right? We have three strategic imperatives. We call them delivering on our promise. And I am so gratified that I think everyone on our campus, or most of them on our campus, will tell you what those three things are. The first of them is student success, which is our North Star. So coming to it from the lens of student success, what is it that our students need? How do we support them the best is what we went into this question with. And we found at times that separating out these different kinds of centers was actually not necessarily serving the students who went to get support from there that well. And in some cases, their performance was lower than those who are not going to those places. And so we focused on rethinking about this, that having a set of a community hub, if you will, that supported all students, irrespective of color, race, gender, right? We want success for all students. For every student, we want to make sure that they're getting the right kind of support they need, the tutorial help, et cetera, et cetera. I think the campus is seeing the value of it. There'll always be some opposition to these things, but I would say most people on campus are seeing that we're going in the right direction.
A lot of folks in the higher ed world have been saying over the last year and a half or so that they feel like they are sort of under attack from the federal government, that academic freedom is at risk, First Amendment rights are at risk, research funding, as we talked about, are at risk, the ability to bring in students from other places are at risk. Do you feel that way? Do you feel like higher ed is under attack from the Trump administration?
So I'm sure you know, as does the whole world, that we were one of the nine universities that were invited to consider the compact that was sent around. You know, would I want to be on that list? Not necessarily, but I'm told that we were on the list because we were making all the right kinds of changes in terms of, you know, freezing tuition for in-state students and being very thoughtful about the, you know, budgets and getting them jobs and all this sort of stuff. So ironically, what that did is it brought our campus community together. We were able to have lots of conversations. I consulted the Faculty Senate with various groups. There were all kinds of opinions, but ultimately it led us to offer a very sort of enriched, with all this community input, response, which I think most people would say was the most thoughtful response, most comprehensive response to the compact that of any university. And so it gave the campus an opportunity to think through these challenges. I will say that I've been in higher education for 40 years now. There are certainly things universities should be focused on that perhaps some lost their way. I think being as lean as possible in administration is important, making it as affordable as possible for our students, making it as accessible as possible, focusing on our strengths in terms of research. And as a land grant, and I'm a product of land grant universities, I truly think our land-grant mission drives a lot of what we do. We believe in engaging across all counties, all of our tribal nations, independent of whether anyone from the outside was forcing us to do this. It was important for us to focus, be selective on what we should be spending our time and effort on, and that's what we're doing, and I think we'll be better for that.
Well, so you mentioned the compact, and when it was known that U of A was invited to join this, there are a lot of folks on campus whose response was, and I'm going to say it in a way that one can say it on the radio, heck no, like no way, don't do it. And that, as you referenced, was not what the response ultimately was. What were those conversations like? Because clearly there are a lot of folks on campus who are concerned that if the U of A signed on to this, there are all sorts of worries of like, this is the end of academic freedom. The federal government's going to tell us what to do. Like, we're not going to be able to do the kind of research that we want to do and think is important. So I'm curious what those conversations were like. Yeah.
You know, of course, this was a surprise to everyone. And so the immediate reaction often ends up being a knee-jerk reaction. I understand all the perspectives we heard. We heard from legislators. We heard from alumni. We heard from students, from faculty, from other universities. Other presidents of other universities, and I consulted with a lot of them. So the important thing was to not, you know, sort of have a knee-jerk reaction to this thing. Consider what is being conveyed. We had conversations with the federal government. They made it clear that this was, you know, something they were offering for us to consider, and they were open to feedback. And that's something that was not well known, right? And so it was important for me and for the provost and for all of us to have very honest, very open conversations with groups of faculty, alumni, students, and all that. And we did. We spent a lot of time listening to them. And I'll tell you that our final response really mirrored a lot of what we heard. The university felt like we should point out what we're already doing and what we think is a good thing. And that's what we ended up doing. So I think the faculty senate meeting that attended after sending in the response was the one time and maybe the only time that I got applause. Everybody gave me a standing ovation when I went in. So I think we handled it as well as possible. You know, it's not over. I think we need to continue to be vigilant about doing the right thing ourselves without anyone forcing us to do it. And that's what you'll get from me.
When you look at what higher education might look like in 1, 3, 5 years, what do you see?
I think the U of A will be one of the top universities in the country, and I'll do all I can to do that. I think higher education will change. It's always been changing, right? I think there may have been a sense of complacency at some point, but we need to be better at deploying our resources better. We need to diversify our sources. We need to make a case for to our alumni, to foundations, to companies to work more closely with us. So I think you'll see much more of that. And you'll see that students vote with their feet, parents vote with their feet. So we want to be as attractive an institution for our parents, our students, our companies that are looking for a workforce that we can be. And I am extremely optimistic about the future of the University of Arizona. It has such great strengths that, okay, so we had a little bit of sort of a budget challenge and such along the way, but truly the fact that we have a great leadership team now, that the campus is ready for that leadership and is collaborating and cooperating, that our private sector partners and others are excited about where we are, I think we're going to be standing tall and doing better after this.
All right. We'll have to leave it there. That is Suresh Garamella, president of the University of Arizona. President Garamella, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Mark.
This weekend, Arizona Roller Derby will hold its 6th annual Cactus Cup competition. And our next guest this morning will be there holding clinics to teach newcomers and veterans alike a little something about the rough and tumble sport. Tanisha Bonaby is a roller derby player and coach who goes by the name Freight Train. We'll find out why in just a few minutes. But when I spoke with her earlier this morning, we began with her love of skating, which she began when she was just 2 years old with her dad. By the time she was a tween, she was dance skating.
It would be called rhythm skating. Some people call it jam skating. When I was younger, of course, I always grew up in the rhythm skating world at Alameda Skating Rink in Houston, Texas. But I didn't really start getting into some of the more technical skills of rhythm skating until I was like 10, 11, 12. So that could mean doing the move downtown or crazy legs, spinning. So.
Wait, what's crazy legs?
It's a dance skating skill where you are moving your legs in a certain pattern. I could show you what that is.
Too hard to describe on the radio. Okay, no problem. No problem.
It's footwork, shuffle skating skills that you can do in the middle of a skate floor.
Super cool. Okay, I think I can guess. Okay, so it was later on when you were in college that you got into roller derby, right?
Right. I was introduced to it by my dad because he was getting his skates fixed at a local skate shop called Montrose Skate Shop. The guy who owned the place was Mr. John, and he was really into roller derby. So he asked my dad, did he have a daughter? And then, of course, my dad said yes. And he gave my dad a flyer, and my dad gave me the flyer.
So what did you think when you first got on a roller derby rink? Like, was this kind of revelatory for you? Were you like, this is awesome, and I love this?
So as you can imagine, I like roller skating. I love roller skating. I always have. So I was kind of excited about it because it was a sport played on roller skates. Mm-hmm. I will say that me and my brothers were looking at roller derby in the middle of the night before I joined. And we was looking at some of the old school roller derby where, you know, they was getting hit in all kinds of ways and flying off the track and all that stuff. So I had mixed feelings about it because I just didn't know what to expect.
Right.
But I'm really glad that I joined.
Right. So roller derby is a sport, but I think a lot of folks might think about roller derby and think about kind of an old version of it where it was almost like professional wrestling. Like there were moves, fights, things like that happening that were kind of planned.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's it look like today?
Well, so there's many different variations of roller derby. The one that I play is under the WFTDA organization, and it's played on a flat track. Okay. So there are still some leagues that play on a bank track, like what you would have saw on TV. But now we play it on a flat track because it's more accessible to leagues all over the world, right? Not mm-hmm. everyone can have a bank track. So it's mostly played on a flat track. But we have defined rules. And, you know, under those rules, we play the sport and there's no theatrics or fakeness involved at all. It's real people hitting each other off the track and down and jumping and all the other stuff. So none of it's planned. It's all skilled and strategic.
And you can get kind of beat up, right?
You can. You definitely can. I wouldn't let that deter you or deter others from joining roller derby, though. It's a really great sport to be a part of. But yes, sometimes you can get bumps and bruises and things like that.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So you went on to kind of be really involved in roller derby. You still are. You teach it now, obviously. You joined the Texas Roller Girls, though, when you were younger, which was an incredibly influential, I understand, team in roller derby.
Yeah. So I did 3 years with Houston Roller Derby, and then I decided to try to take my skills to the next level by moving to another team that was nearby who were higher ranked, which was the Texas Roller Girls. So what's significant about the Texas Roller Girls is they are the ones that revived roller derby, the modern day roller derby. They brought it back. And now it's grown to a whole bunch of leagues all over the place.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely, including here. So you'll be here this weekend as part of Arizona's Roller Derby's Cactus Cup, right? So you're going to be teaching folks how to roller derby. So tell us, like, what do we need to know first?
Well, some of the folks that will be coming in, they will already have some roller derby skills under their belt. What I'm going to try to do is define those skills and get them as an individual to understand the way that I play, which will hopefully inspire them to think about how they play the sport of roller derby. So for me, I have certain things that I do to jam in the way that I jam. Does that make sense? I don't know if you've seen roller derby before, but
I've
have
watched
a very
it.
Particular style.
Okay, so tell us, like, what's your particular style? Yeah.
So I'm more of a punchy, hitting, pushing type of Jaren. So I do know how to jump around and be agile and juke and jump and move pretty quick.
Right.
But I'm mostly known for hitting people out of the way or kind of blasting through the wall. What I try to do is help people understand where to utilize some of the skills that I'm doing. So I'm not always pushing to be pushing. There's a certain time when I do it. There's a certain time when I hit people. So that's what I'm going to kind of go over. And then on the second day, we'll be working on firming up some of our blocking and offense and jammer coordination. And that's kind of what I have planned.
Okay. So folks can learn a lot from you this weekend, it sounds like.
Yes, they can learn a lot from me this weekend. But I would say if you're a beginner person and you've never played roller derby before, the first thing you want to know how to do is learn how to skate forward and then be able to take a hit. So if I'm doing an introductory roller derby course with someone completely new, those are the first foundational things we will learn.
Okay. So let me ask you before I let you go, Tanisha, how did you get the name Freight Train? Because I know everyone in roller derby has a name kind of like this, right?
Mm-hmm. So what happened was when I played in my very first scrimmage back in Houston roller derby, I didn't have a name yet. When I came into the pack, because I didn't know the rules, I hit the pack so hard that everybody flew away from me and fell down to the ground. So they said, if you don't have a roller derby name yet, we're just going to call you Freight Train. So my name was given to me by one of my teammates, Becky Booty, back in Houston.
All right. Sounds like it was an appropriate one, given your skill set.
Yeah.
All right.
I thought it was pretty cool, so I kept it.
All right. Well, Tanisha Bonnaby, a.k.a. Freight Train, will be in Phoenix this weekend at the Arizona Roller Derby's Cactus Cup, teaching folks how to roller derby. And she's joining us this morning to talk more about it. Tanisha, thank you so much for coming on the show. I appreciate it.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. The WNBA and its players have reached agreement on a new collective bargaining agreement. Assuming it's approved by union membership and the league's board of governors, the salary cap and minimum salaries will increase, as will the amount of revenue sharing, among other provisions. The deal came after a year of pretty contentious talks. More recently, the sides spent some long days and nights together as they neared a deal, and it now means that teams and players have a lot to do before the season is scheduled to start in early May. With me now to talk about all this is Sabrina Merchant with The Athletic. Sabrina, good morning.
Good morning.
So what are some of the highlights of the new CBA, which some of the union membership has called transformational?
Yeah, I think the money is really the biggest highlight. You know, previously, the WNBA never had a salary cap that was tied to revenue. It was just fixed increases. And now with all of the money the league is bringing in, the players made that their number one priority of wanting their salaries to be directly governed by the revenue sharing, which is 20% over the life of the CBA. So that's going to result in salary cap of $7 million in 2026 compared to $1.5 million last year. Hmm. You've got maximum salaries of $1.4 million in this deal. Again, basically equivalent to the cap last year. And minimum salaries of about $300,000, which is more than the maximum salary of $250,000 last year.
How did they get here? Because, you know, I remember last year at the All-Star game, the players were wearing T-shirts that said basically pay us what we're worth. Like this was not a kumbaya kind of thing from the beginning.
No, I think it's very fair to call this a contentious set of negotiations. I mean, you mentioned the pay us what you owe us shirts. We also had Nafisa Collier, who's one of the vice presidents of the union, basically using her exit interview as a bully pulpit to call out Kathy Engelbert and the WNBA leadership for being the worst in the world. Mm. And then they're sitting in a room together for 8 days trying to figure out a new agreement. So I think there was an understanding that, hey, you know, the finances of the WNBA have changed dramatically since the last time we sat down to bargain in 2020. Obviously, there's a lot more money coming to the league. And even though ownership wants to be compensated for all the years where they footed the bill when the league was not making money, the players are also the biggest driver of revenue and they deserve a big cut of it, especially because you think about why the league has become popular. It's because of these college megastars like Caitlin Clark, Angel Reese, Paige Beckers entering the league. So I think it was an understanding that, like, yes, both sides have you know, want the money that is coming into the league, but the players were, I think, more willing to hold out than you'll see in other labor negotiations because the WNBA is not their primary source of income. They've been preparing for a work stoppage for multiple years, and the owners really saw an opportunity to get money into the WNBA for the first time and didn't want to waste it.
Hmm. Well, so I wonder about that because, the WNBA has seen, as we've talked about before, a surge in popularity because of players like Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese and Paige Beckers and others. Was there a sense, maybe between both sides, maybe just on one side or the other, that this was not a great time to maybe have a self-inflicted wound of missing games or canceling a season?
Absolutely. I think there was, an understanding from the players and the league, and both sides publicly said it, like, we need to play basketball this year. And you don't usually hear that from ownership when there is a lockout or a work stoppage. And I should be clear, there was no actual work stoppage triggered by the WNBA. They were just in a weird status quo period.
Yeah.
But usually when you're in these labor negotiations, the owners and the league are willing to hold out and wait and sort of squeeze the players. And this was a rare situation where the WNBA was like, no, we actually need to play games right now. We have this golden goose and we can't afford to sit out. And I think that gave the players union a unique source of leverage to get a lot of what they were looking for in this deal.
Yeah. So again, assuming that this is ratified by the league and the union, and I've not read, maybe I assume you would feel the same way. There's no reason to believe that it won't be. What has to happen now? Because as you've reported, there's a lot that happens in the next several weeks.
Yeah. So just for clarification, the WNBA offseason usually starts February 1st and then has like a 1 month, 2 month free agency period before we get into the draft, and then training camps start after that. And now we're looking at 5 weeks of free agency wow. and training camp and, the start of the season. Plus, because the WNBA is welcoming two new teams into the league, the Toronto Tempo and the Portland Fire, they have to have expansion drafts for those two teams. So that's another, scheduled event during the offseason has to take place before the college draft and before free agency. And we should mention free agency, because everybody knew the new CBA was coming up this year. Every veteran in the league, save for two, so we have more than 100 players who are unrestricted free agents this
wow.
offseason and will have to sign new contracts.
Oh my gosh.
So there is a lot of business to be done before training camp starts on April 19th and then the season tips off on May 8th.
So does that mean that we should be looking for a lot of, if not player movement, then like a lot of signings coming up in the next several days and weeks?
Yes. So I think you're right about not necessarily a ton of player movement, because people aren't necessarily signing new contracts because they want to leave. It's just because, they're going to be making 4 to 5 times as much money on these contracts as they would, yeah. Had they signed a longer term contract before. But yeah, there's going to be a lot of deals signed. We've already seen, reports of Asia Wilson, will be signing a Supermax contract in Las Vegas, which of course. But yeah, lots of deals will be coming through the pipeline. I don't think most of them are going to start to hit the paper until early April. WNBA front offices have a lot to do right now, just scouting the NCAA tournament.
Right.
So lots of things going on.
Well, so I got to ask, in the last minute or so we have, the Phoenix Mercury, of course, made a very surprising run to the WNBA finals last season. Any sense of if they can bring back some percentage of that core that they have, or if there are free agents that they might be looking at?
Well, the goal when they assembled the trio of Satu Sabli, Alyssa Thomas, and Kalia Copper last year was that this would be their foundation for years to come. And again, just because they're free agents this year doesn't mean that they didn't enjoy their experience in Phoenix or not want to come back. And, you see all of the social media and public statements, from the front office talking about how much they're looking forward to the future with the team. Kalia Copper and Nate Tibbetts just went with Team USA to their World Cup qualifying tournament. They obviously look like they're going to be spending a lot of time together going forward, not just as parts of Team USA. So I would imagine that, yes, AT, Satu, Ka are all going to be back in Mercury uniforms. How they build out the rest of the roster is an open question, because, they had a lot of first-year players in the WNBA last year, and they might, have other opportunities or maybe not want to come back to the league. Who knows? So the trio of stars, I'd be very surprised if that didn't land back in Phoenix, but, nine other players on the roster. So we'll see how that plays out.
All right. We'll see what happens. That is Sabrina Merchant with The Athletic. Sabrina, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Tomorrow marks the kickoff of the Oh My Ears Festival, which will feature a wide range of what's often referred to as new music. It's a loosely defined genre that refers broadly to innovative approaches to classical music instrumentation and composition. Many of the groups invited to the festival seek to challenge audience expectations of what a classical performance looks like and sounds like, including our next guests, who call themselves the Shutterspeed Duo. Eric Bargagne and Ford Ferquin are both composers and multi-instrumentalists, but when they work together under the Shutterspeed banner, they add a third layer to their work: video projection. Their shows combine moody, tonally adventurous electric guitar, clarinet, and synthesizer music with film footage. They're performing at the Oh My Ears Festival this Sunday, and when they spoke with our co-host, Sam Dingman.
The big driving factor for our group is that we want there to be a visual component. When you go to our show, we want you to feel engrossed in the environment. We want there to be these experimental visuals that we make that are playing behind us that either reflect the music, or sometimes we're actually playing to the video. At least for me, it feels more like a rock band approach to writing classical music, essentially.
Yeah.
It's a weird combination of instruments with electric guitar and electronics and clarinet and all these other things.
Yes, yes. I'm glad you brought that up, because I have to say, one of the first things that drew me to your music was this combination of electric guitar and electrified clarinet. Was that a sound that you guys kind of made your way to as the partnership kind of grew, or was it something that kind of clicked in for you both right away? Ford, what's your side of that story?
We are both people who are interested in post-minimal music, but we're also interested in ambient and rock music, and there's a lot of opportunity with electric guitar to sort of dive into that world, but it's not really explored super well on the clarinet. So
okay,
being able to process the clarinet using different types of electronic effects, different types of EQing, reverb, different types of delay, we can sort of dive into this new sound world. And when you blend and amplify everything, you have this ability to match what is an inherently loud instrument, electric guitar, with clarinet, which can be loud at points, but when you amplify it, they're on equal playing field. So you can
right.
really create a more punchy aesthetic that is bridging into non-classical worlds. I think we're drawn to it as classical musicians because some of the most important composers of our generation are writing in this style. Think about composers that you might have heard of, like Philip Glass or Steve Reich. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. there's a lot of crossover with things that we just grew up listening to. I used to listen to like punk bands when I was in like high school and college. And
uh-huh. Uh-huh.
there's a lot of potential to cross genres there.
Yeah. So let me ask you both. I'm glad you brought up Philip Glass and other composers of that era. I had a conversation on the show a while back with some folks who were playing some Philip Glass compositions, and one of the things that they talked about trying to induce in their performance is this idea that by playing these repeated melodies over and over again, the audience starts to hear things that aren't necessarily there, quote unquote, on the page, but that because of the combination of sounds and the repetition of them, it induces this kind of trance state. I don't know if that's something you guys are going for specifically, but since you cited that as an influence and since we've talked about the visual layer of the music, is that related to what's interesting to you about having a visual component to your work?
With a lot of our tracks, the visual component is diving into this sort of like parallel space or mm-hmm. negative space. My piece, Water Triptych, is based off of three different images of water that all found video footage that's manipulated. One's Reese Beach in Queens, one is the Gowanus Canal in Brooklyn, and the other is Inishere, off the coast of Ireland. And all of these images, if you look at them as found footage, are very like bright, colorful, and vibrant. But what I end up doing with the images is actually just flipping them into the negative, process thing, and doing some pixelation to create what is possibly described as like psychedelic, I guess. But it's a different way of looking at like the color and the motion and sort of taking away that primary element of the source material and looking at it as just color, shape, and sound.
Eric, what about you? What's intriguing to you about the visual layer of all this?
One thing that I really liked about a lot of the concerts that I went to from like the age of 16 to 22 in Central Florida, you would come and see these bands like Of Montreal, or like when Radiohead came through, they all had basically stage shows. They had these visual projections. They had a lot of things going on, and it, you know, also goes into how bands would have lighting and like fog machines and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I really like that kind of Gesamtkunstwerk element of it, that all-encompassing...
Wait, what was that word?
It's the Gesamtkunstwerk of a thing. It's like you have this all-encompassing art idea.
Gesamtkunstwerk? Am I saying that right?
That's such a bougie term, Eric. Don't use that term.
I'm sorry. I just came from school.
No, listen, it's okay. I think people are going to be into this. I just want to make sure I'm saying it correctly.
That's right.
Gesamtkunstwerk.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's like all-encompassing art, and it's something that comes from like opera in like the 19th century is where people start talking about it a lot. But it's like having like all elements of your experience like controlled and curated, and it feels like it's this encompassing event.
What does the current version of writing together look like? Because I have the sense watching you that there's a lot of really close listening to each other that's happening, and a lot of improvising. It seems like there's a really organically evolving quality to the music.
It's very organic in the way that we put it together. So there are pieces that are Ford's, there are pieces that are mine, but we are interpreting them simultaneously. So you do, no matter what, you'll always have a touch of the other person. And then in terms of improvisation, on one hand, there is a decent amount just based on like if it's a graphic score, it's really hard to literally play a picture. So with those kind of things.
Yeah. I have to ask, Ford, can you give me an example of what a graphic score would look like?
If you've ever seen something like a Jackson Pollock work or a Mondrian, it could be any one of those two extremes. It could be very strict straight lines, very like splattered, like maximal all over the page, and everything in between. And the way we're interpreting these things is we're making these decisions in what for the two of us is like a shared language. If we see something that's more dense on the page, we might play something more aggressive or something punchier. If it's bigger on the page, it might be a larger cluster of sound. If it's smaller, it might be a more subtle whisper.
Well, listeners can hear the result of this fascinating form of collaboration between Eric Barganier and Ford Firquin right here in Phoenix at the Oh My Ears Festival on March 22nd. Eric and Ford, thank you for this conversation.
Thank you, Sam.
Thank you so much.
That'll do it for the show. For Mark Brody and Sam Dingman, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayanna Hamilton. The show was created by John Hoban. Our executive producer is Amy Silverman. You can find more of the show and sign up for our newsletter at theshow.kjzz.org. You can also find us on Instagram at @kjzztheshow.